Hey there, kindred spirits. Welcome to Kindred Spirits Book Club, where three grown-ass ladies geek out about Anne of Green Gables. I'm Reagan Duffy, and I'm here with my birthday queen co-host, Kelly Gerner,
Woo-hoo!
And our special guest, returning friend of the pod, Dr. Brenna Clark Gray. Hi, Kelly and Brenna.
Hi.
Hi, Reagan.
Listeners, you guys will all remember Brenna from our episode at the end of last season on the somewhat bananas miniseries, Anne of Green Gables, the sequel, or Anne of Avonlea, depending where you watched it. And that was a truly wild ride of an episode.
We're glad to have you back, Brenna.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me again.
And hopefully a significantly less bananas topic today.
We couldn't be more bananas.
Well, listeners, it is our favorite kindred spirits, Kelly's birthday this week. Happy birthday, Kel.
Thank you so much. It is my birthday the week that we're recording. And by the time this episode actually comes out, almost 6 weeks later, I will have been 42 for a long time. I will be fully settled into my role and I'll be able to look back on this moment and think about how young and naive I was.
Okay, Miss Cornelia.
I was so happy this past weekend to host a birthday party that Reagan went to and lots of other dear, dear friends were able to attend as well. I think we talked about this a couple episodes ago, but for my party, we did a favorite things party, which I had seen on TikTok because I'm very young and hip. And we had so much fun. All the guests brought three of their favorite things. Everybody showed them off. And then you could go and pick three of your favorite things from that group to go bring home. So then everybody came home with gifts, right? Reagan's gifts went so fast. Everybody loved them. She did these adorable nail stickers from Dashing Diva. She did these little like mini brands mystery balls with plants in them, like little plastic plants, I think, not real plants.
Not real. No, not real plants.
And what was the third thing? Oh, a lip oil.
I was actually very proud of myself because it feels good to pick something where people are like, oh, yes, you have great taste. I like being affirmed in this way.
Other friends brought like little board games, which I thought was like a fun, different idea.
Also went really, really fast. There were almost elbows thrown over the board games.
Lots and lots of skincare. There's all sorts of good stuff.
It was fun because there was so many different types of things, right? Everything from coffee to fuzzy slippers to practical, like the meal planning pad. I still love one of those. I didn't take
that. I got the meal planning pad. It's such a good idea. Yep.
Right. To like fun, frivolous things. Kelly did these clips, which I am wearing right now because I took one of those.
Yeah. They're these like flat claw clips. So it's not the kind of, so it's like the classic claw clip, but they're flat.
The classic,
so they're not
in my hair right now.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, so Brenna's wearing like the classic claw clip, but that kind of sticks out of your head a couple inches. Cool. But the flat one is snug up against your head.
Ah.
Yeah. So you can like lean back on your chair or lie down. Those are very cool. I'm kind of obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brenna, if you were in town, we totally would have invited you to the favorite things party. What would you have brought?
Yes, good question.
Oh, that's a hard question.
Yeah, not to put you on the spot. And our budget was between $15 and $20.
Oh, I like that. So we have this candy company in, well, I shouldn't say weeks. It's in Montreal, so on the other side of the country, but it's called Swish. And they make like these gourmet, well, gummies, basically. They make gummy candies. They make a gin and tonic flavored, like little gummies. So
yum.
I probably brought bags of those. They also have ice wine ones and mojito ones, but the gin and tonics are like very good. Yeah. Yeah. There's my little pitch for Squish gummies. Please send me products.
Willing to be sponsored.
I keep saying it. Nobody ever calls back.
I know. Just keep putting it out in the universe.
You know what? Someday the right person is going to hear it.
Okay. Well, that sounds amazing. You definitely would have been a hit at the party with gummies.
Yeah,
there was a fair amount of candy. There were quite a few comestibles. People were into it. I mean, truly, it was people's favorite things. So
Yeah.
Well, anyway, folks, let's come back to our topic at hand. For those of you who don't remember, let me refresh your memory about Brenna and why we invited her. Brenna has a PhD in Canadian literature and a lifelong fandom of all things Anne, and Anne's House of Dreams is her favorite Anne book. So, of course, we had to have her come back this season. She's a professor at a regional university in the interior desert of British Columbia, and she co-hosts the awesome young adult literature podcast called Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star. And we're so glad you were able to come back to us, Brenna.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yay, Brenna.
Well, tell us a little bit about why House of Dreams is your favorite Anne book.
Yeah, I was trying to think of it when you actually asked me that directly. I was like, why is it my favorite one? But I think it's because, I'm just so happy for Anne and Gilbert, and they have this long courtship, and we wait so long to see them finally be together. And so I really feel like as Anne fans, we have earned book five. Like, I feel like we trudged through the desert of book four and we
Yes.
earned book five. And it's just a really good payoff. Very rare that a fifth book in a series is the emotional core, but I actually kind of think it is. Even today, rereading the end part again, just before I joined you guys today, like, it still makes me cry. I cry when Anne is watching Diana with her children, and I cry at the wedding, and I cry when they first cross the threshold at the House of Dreams. Like, I just cry a million times. And yeah, I just think of all the books, this one has the biggest emotional heart for me.
It really does. We've talked a lot this season already about how this is like a deeply emotional, a deeply adult book.
Well, and it's funny because in book one, Matthew's death gets me every single time. Like, I
Of
always
course.
cry when
Yeah, of
Matthew
course.
dies, but that's the only time in book one, I think, where I still like really get emotional. Whereas I was really struck by how when I was reading this mostly at the pool while my kid was in swimming lessons, and I'd be like welling up at the pool. It's amazing how much it still gets me just over and over again throughout the book.
Well, and I'm sure all of our listeners have noticed this far into our House of Dreams season that this book has a lot of grown-up themes and sadness and tragedy running through it. And one of the most prominent ones that certainly means more to me now than it ever did as a teen reading this book is the theme around motherhood. So today we are going to be tackling all of the different ways this comes up in the book, and that includes infant loss and maternal mortality and infertility. So listeners, if those aren't safe topics for you right now, just go ahead, feel free to skip this one. But we wouldn't be doing this book justice if we didn't explore some of those issues here.
Yeah, co-signing that, listeners. As we're going to get into a little bit further, we are all very familiar with how fraught the experience of becoming a mother can be. We love that this podcast is a warm and cozy spot for many folks, and we hope that you will take care of yourself and skip this episode if you know you aren't up for these topics. So it's all about Anne Blythe as our kindred spirit of this episode. Since the book really centers Anne's experience of becoming a mother in these first 2 years of her marriage, we have to bring the focus back onto her. And honestly, we see Anne grow profoundly in this book. Yes, she's still the gentle dreamer we love, but her experiences with tragedy, whether her own loss or those of her friends and neighbors, gives greater weight and importance to her ability to continue to dream and hope, even in the face of grief. This is a painful but important journey for Anne that shapes her adult life, and she really experiences all the hope and joy and pain in the 2 years of this book.
For our quote of the episode, let's talk about how Maud describes Anne just after baby Joyce is born and Anne becomes a mother. Anne, her pale face blanched with its baptism of pain, her eyes aglow with the holy passion of motherhood, did not need to be told to think of her baby. She thought of nothing else. For a few hours, she tasted of happiness so rare and exquisite that she wondered if the angels in heaven did not envy her. Little Joyce, she murmured when Marilla came in to see the baby. We planned to call her that if she were a girlie. There were so many we would have liked to name her for. We couldn't choose between them. So we decided on Joyce. We can call her Joy for short. Joy. It suits so well. Oh, Marilla, I thought I was happy before. Now I know that I just dreamed a pleasant dream of happiness. This is the reality. This moment is shining and beautiful, although it's heartbreaking because we know what comes afterwards. But it's a moment that changes Anne forever.
I love this quote, and I know you guys already have done the sort of love story part, but I have to tell you that my favorite quote in the book is when Anne first comes down the stairs on her wedding day, because we use that as a reading in our wedding. It's such a good quote. Yeah.
That's a perfect choice for a wedding reading.
I love that, Brenna. That is a beautiful, beautiful quote.
Yeah, I love it so much.
I actually love that Anne has been part of several weddings. In our very last episode, our guest Kelly Tager walked down the aisle to music from the Anne miniseries.
Oh.
And I referenced Anne and Gilbert in my wedding vows, and I used a quote in our bookmark favors. So
No.
Anne's been a part of quite a few Kindred Spirits weddings.
Well, as we've said before, that any of us who kind of grew up, centered on Anne and Gilbert's romance were setting themselves up for success from the beginning. Such a good role model for relationship happiness.
True.
So let's get into our story club and discuss all the ways that motherhood and the often fraught journey to motherhood or around motherhood shows up in this book. Right at the very beginning, we get these little bits that allude to Anne starting her journey to motherhood, sort of mentally preparing. She sees, quote, Diana cuddling small Anne Cordelia with the inimitable gesture of motherhood, which always sent through Anne's heart, filled with sweet unuttered dreams and hopes, a thrill that was half pure pleasure and half a strange ethereal pain. So watching Diana as a mother now on the verge of Anne's wedding triggers very different feelings in Anne than when she watched Diana with baby Fred just a few years ago. At that moment, Anne felt that Diana's motherhood made her like a little distance from Anne, Diana having experienced something deeply profound that at that point, Anne not only couldn't conceive of, but didn't even really think of something that was going to happen to her. In fact, at that time, she felt really lonely watching Diana, you know, and of course, that's also kind of enhanced by the fact that Anne was feeling discouraged about her future because she just rejected Roy and she doesn't know that she loves Gilbert and she thinks that Gilbert is with Christine. Like, Anne is just all in a muddle. Like, motherhood is very far off from her at that time. But now, right at the beginning of House of Dreams, Anne is watching Diana with her daughter, and Anne is starting to step into that identity as Gilbert's wife and all that entails. And that allows Anne to let herself want motherhood, let herself hope or even yearn for motherhood in a way she probably didn't let herself experience earlier. And right here at the very top of this book, when Maud is sort of foreshadowing this theme of motherhood for us, we see how familiar Maud herself was with these feelings that often come up for women when it comes to motherhood. Like, I never would have clocked Anne's progression here as a younger reader, but now at this phase in my life, Anne's emotional experience with Diana feels very honest and true to me. And, you know, I remember when you were pregnant with your daughter, Alice Reagan, and at that time, my heart was just full of unmitigated joy for you, right? I'm a couple years younger than you. And like Anne with Diana's first baby, little Fred, I was just like so happy for you and your husband, but a little removed because I wasn't really in that phase of life for myself yet. Right? It was just sort of like, what a cool thing that's happening for my friends. I, you know, can't wait to meet her. But I wasn't thinking of it as having any kind of reflection on me because I just wasn't there yet. So, but then a few years later, when my mind did start to shift toward trying to decide whether and how to become a mother, all of my friends' pregnancies felt very different to me. You know, of course, I was always happy for them, but like Anne with Diana's second baby, I felt that pain and pleasure, hope and fear mix that Maud is talking about here. So I'm wondering, what do you guys remember about how you felt about motherhood before you were moms? And then what changed once you were pregnant and once you had your kids?
Ooh, okay, interesting question. I have always, always worked with children, from babysitting as a tween through all the facets of my career. And I loved it. And I identified as someone who is good with kids and would likely have a family. I definitely dreamed of having a big family as a kid, and probably inspired by all of these old-fashioned books I read with huge families. Like, twins came up a lot in my fantasies. I don't know. But then they just seemed like so much fun, like two for the price of one. This seems great. But then as an adult, my feelings are a lot more complicated about it. So one factor was I was surrounded by and I worked with so many families in my professional life in a job that was really very intense and draining just emotionally. So I kind of wondered, do I want to have a family? Because will I feel like I have anything left for a family of my own at the end of the day? Like, do I have anything left to give? And then when I was starting to really want a more serious relationship, it felt kind of like tempting fate to dwell too long on really wanting children, because that could maybe just not happen for me. So I didn't really let myself imagine it very much. When my sister got pregnant with my oldest nephew, I remember surprising myself and bursting into tears, not because I was jealous of her, but because I finally admitted to myself that I had kind of secretly hoped to raise my kids to be close in age with her kids. And here she was pregnant and I wasn't married yet. And the relationship that I was in at the time hadn't settled on whether or not it was truly serious. And it surprised me because I didn't realize that I felt as strongly about it as I did. And well, that relationship was with Steve, and we did get serious and we did get married. And only then, after we were married, did it feel like it was safe to kind of actually allow myself to want to have kids. But then, you know, of course, finding out that sometimes it's not actually as easy to get pregnant as you might think it is, that was a really emotional year for me. I had finally let myself want this deeply important thing and been in a place where that could theoretically, like, I thought, like, that was the hard part, was finding somebody that I wanted to have a kid with. And then all of a sudden it was kind of in doubt about whether or not it would happen for us. And then once I was pregnant, it sometimes still felt like I could jinx it by talking about it too early or letting myself imagine too much of who this baby would be once she arrived. So it was kind of this funny line to walk. Like I was joyfully anticipating it, but it also felt like dangerous to deeply want it. Mm-hmm. So I felt like when she was born, I felt this profound relief. She was here and she was safe. And I felt like I let out a breath that I'd been holding for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at that point, I was free just to love her and watch her grow.
For me, I was never sure I wanted kids. And I think that, you know, I'm very much a youngest child by a large margin. Wasn't around kids. My parents' friends didn't have kids that were littler than me. So like, I just never really never thought about it very much. Mm-hmm. And then also I'm an academic and like academia is really hostile to women with children. And so like all of my mentors until my PhD, I didn't have any mentors who had children. So it also just seemed like something that was very incompatible with the life that I thought that I wanted. And so it wasn't until I was married and settled in my career and had seen a few people have kids and academic career that I started to seriously consider it. Although even then, like, I think I was the first woman to take mat leave in my department for like a decade. Like people
just
like, won't even know how we're going to deal with this. Yeah. So
Brenna, that is nuts.
Yeah. And because I was very young when I finished my PhD and got my first job really young, nobody else in my department was like just anywhere near my age. So even people who did have kids had like teenagers. Right. So
yeah.
But when we did decide, my first pregnancy was really easy and calm. It was all the things that Anne is expecting her life to be. In many ways, the time I spent pregnant and then on maternity leave, and I always feel guilty telling Americans this, but my mat leave was 20 months long.
Oh my gosh!
You know, I know. But yeah, that was really the happiest and the most peaceful time of my life.
I like, love that.
My job had been very stressful. And so being off and away from it and, you know, just being in kind of kid land was amazing. My feelings would get much more complicated over time, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later when talking about things like miscarriage and stuff. But deciding to have a baby and getting pregnant and being pregnant and early motherhood was a really like easy time of great pleasure. It's exactly what Anne feels at the end of the book with Jem. What we wanted for her with Joy. I really did have that experience. I was hugely grateful for that.
Oh, I love that, Brenna. So when we meet Miss Cornelia, we get a little more foreshadowing around babies, right? Because Miss Cornelia, she shows up ready for a new baby. She's bringing with her this baby dress that she's sewing for the 8th Proctor baby, a child who's not particularly wanted, but who Miss Cornelia still wants to celebrate with all the special little details and extra efforts that a much longed for baby would have had. So this little baby dress here is also signaling a recurring motif throughout the book. We start with the little dress that Miss Cornelia is sewing for the Proctor baby. And then we have the lovely baby dress that Leslie makes for Anne and to welcome Anne's very much anticipated baby as best she can. And then that baby dress becomes poor little Joyce's burial shroud. And then we end the book with Anne being joyfully sad to have to shorten the baby dresses for healthy baby Jem as he moves out of newbornhood into babyhood. Here's what the book tells us about Leslie's baby dress for Joyce. But one evening, when late winter was listening for the word of spring, Leslie came over to the little house for a twilight chat, and when she went away, she left a small white box on the table. Anne found it after she was gone and opened it wonderingly. It was a tiny white dress of exquisite workmanship, delicate embroidery, wonderful tucking, sheer loveliness. Every stitch in it was handwork, and the little frills of lace at neck and sleeves were of real Valenciennes. Lying on it was a card, with Leslie's love. What hours of work she must have put on it, said Anne. And the material must have cost more than she could really afford. It is very sweet of her. But Leslie was brusque and curt when Anne thanked her. And again, the latter felt thrown back upon herself. Leslie's gift was not alone in the little house. Miss Cornelia had, for the time being, given up sewing for unwanted, unwelcome 8th babies and fallen to sewing for a very much wanted first one, whose welcome would leave nothing to be desired. Philippa Blake and Diana Wright each sent a marvelous garment, and Mrs. Rachel Lynde sent several, in which good material and honest stitches took the place of embroidery and frills. Anne herself made many, desecrated by no touch of machinery, spending over them the happiest hours of the happy winter.
Honestly, though, baby clothes are like the most fun thing.
Oh, yeah.
I actually started learning to sew when I was pregnant just so I could make cute little baby dresses for Alice, like the ones from Minnie Bowden on like a budget.
You were just like Anne, Reagan.
I was just like Anne, except let me tell you, I use the machine a lot. I loved all of Alice's little baby clothes, like the cute little onesies and sleepers, and then the dresses and baby pants and blankets I made for her too. I bought way too many clothes for her, but I am not sorry. I would do it again. I passed a lot of my favorite ones on to my niece. And then in turn, some of the best ones have been passed on to my cousin's daughter, who passed them on to another cousin's daughter. Mm-hmm. And now there's one last baby girl in the family, the first cousin's newest baby. And she is still inheriting some of those dresses that I made. She sent me a picture of baby Kendall wearing some of the first dresses I sewed for Alice. So I love it when I see a picture of one of those kiddos in either a piece that I made or one of my favorite pieces. Like some of the better quality pieces that I bought are justifying their cost to me mm-hmm. by being worn by several children. So I feel a little bit better. I feel fine about splurging on some of those. That makes me really happy. And then the scraps of my favorite fabrics from those baby dresses, as well as like some of my favorite other onesies and sleepers that I saved. I made two baby clothes quilts with them, one for me and one for my daughter. So like that was really fun. So I still get to have like see some of my favorite fabrics. And I was like, oh, that was her first birthday dress or whatever. So I'm a little sentimental about all those baby clothes.
I mean, there is just something about baby clothes, isn't there? Like, we let children, especially babies, dress for whimsy and fun in a way that we don't allow ourselves as adults. And it is just, I don't know, from my perspective, it is a joy to give clothes that are just like full of rainbows and sparkles and unicorns. When a lot of our friends were having babies kind of in those few years, a gift that my husband and I repeatedly gave to our friends' children was a little hand crocheted Yoda hat from a fiber artist on Etsy. And I loved seeing all those pictures of tiny little babies with giant green Yoda ears. It was so hilarious and adorable. Brenna, what was your favorite outfit for your kiddo when he was little?
Well, I'm not handy at all. It took me the entire pregnancy to knit exactly one blanket. So,
but a perfect blanket, I'm sure.
It was this pattern I read about on the BBC that was like, it was literally called something like a baby blanket no one can screw up. And it was amazing because you just need two skeins of yarn mm-hmm. and you start with one stitch and you add one stitch every row until you're finished the first ball of yarn, so you have a big triangle, and then you take away one stitch every row with the second ball of yarn, so you have another triangle in it. It's a square. Yeah, mm-hmm. and it was self-striping yarn, so like, that's it. But what I miss even more than like the individual items themselves, it's like maybe I'm a control freak, but I miss getting to choose outfits.
Oh yeah,
sadly. It was my favorite, and my kiddos started picking their own outfits like at 2.5. 3 became very opinionated, so I haven't gotten a vote in a long time. But there was this cute little gray sweatshirt that a friend gave us that had like an anthropomorphic bowl of ramen on it, and they always wore it with these gray and black checked leggings that were perfect, and I miss that outfit very much.
Okay, that outfit sounds so genuinely cool and definitely like something I want to wear right now.
Right? Totally.
Yes.
So was there funny. Any particular like dressing phases that your kid went through? Like Alice went through, she was a floor length dress girl for like years. She wore only dresses between like 2.5 and 5, and she much preferred them to be floor length if at all possible.
Oh, so right. I mean, you can tell in many ways, you can tell this is a pandemic kid. Completely gave up on the idea of structured pants, like conceptually, and has not gone back to it. So
same.
Only leggings and sweats. Yeah, same here too. And it's so funny, actually, because today at school drop off, one of the other little kids in class was like, "Are you wearing pajamas?" And my kid was like, "No, these leggings are awesome. They're like leggings with jaguars today." Which we wore with a purple squishmallow shirt, but in Japanese, has squishmallow in Japanese written across the front. And I think it was a bright blue hoodie today. And these cat ears that we got from the wildlife park like 3 years ago. And one of the ears is like half ripped off. So they tuck it underneath the band now and wear it so that it's just like one ear up, one ear down.
Perfect. Oh my gosh. Brenna, is your kid actually the cutest?
Yeah. Yeah, so much cooler than me that it can't even like.
I mean, I have to think though, you know, reflecting back on this quote from the book, Mrs. Rachel, she's the only one whose dresses are going to get worn.
100%. Right?
Because all these other dresses with like the tucks and the frills and the beautiful French lace and all of that, you know, one spit up and that's it for these gowns. But like Mrs. Rachel's, no, those are going to be sturdy and well worn and will make it through repeated washing cycles.
Well, because like, remember what laundry looked like in this time, right?
Like lye. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
It's true.
Thanks, Philippa, but no.
Exactly.
Exactly.
There's definitely a time and place for the fancy frill outfits. And yeah. But most of the time you got to wear some like nice, sturdy, easy to wash clothes.
Totally.
Well, bringing us back to Anne's world, a funny thing that's kind of very much a product of its time that I can catch easier as an adult, but was pretty subtle for me as a kid reading this book, is how Maud never uses the word pregnant or even expecting. It's very subtle little allusions, like this one when Anne and Gilbert are walking home and they're admiring their home light shining in the darkness. And Gilbert says, "When a fellow has a home and a dear little red-haired wife in it, what more need he ask of life?" "Well, he might ask one thing more," whispered Anne happily. "Oh, Gilbert, it seems as if I just couldn't wait for spring." And that's the hint we get about Anne's pregnancy. That's it.
That's it. And you have to be a pretty sharp reader to pick that up. I remember when I finally got to Joy's delivery scene in the book, like as a kid, and I was genuinely shocked. I was like, where did this come from? I had no idea she was pregnant. You know, I missed those hints. But, you know, I think it's strange to us now as modern readers that this detail is so obscured like that. But, you know, we have to remember that Maud herself was very much a product of the Victorian era. And as much as motherhood and children and the whole like angel of the house narrative was idealized in that time, it was also considered obscene to refer openly to sex. So then pregnancy itself represented this sort of like awkward middle time between sex and motherhood. And so it was often clouded in these euphemisms. Some of my favorites are caught, like I've been caught.
Interesting.
A real interesting one. Enceinte, which I think is like a French way of saying pregnant, which I guess it's better if it's French. Unknown, unclear. Or in an interesting condition or in a delicate condition. Mm-hmm. And then also in polite company at that time, labor and delivery would have been called confinement or a laying in. So all these like very pretty refined ways of saying that, well, you're knocked up.
Well, and let's talk timeline here, you guys. Anne and Gilbert are married in September. Baby Joyce is born in early June, which means she was pretty much conceived on their wedding night, more or less. So good job. Great.
I do always think about that wedding night, and you guys probably talked about it last week, but like they get married, they travel 60 kilometers or miles or whatever, however they frame it in the book.
In a horse and buggy.
In a horse and buggy. Then some old man picks them up who Anne's never met before. Then they have to have a meal together and like hang out. And then these people finally leave. The whole time I'm reading that scene, I'm like, oh my God, get out of their house.
Yeah. So Dr. Dave and Mrs. Dr. Dave come over. Captain Jim comes over. We love Captain Jim. This podcast will never say a negative word about Captain Jim. But I mean, he's like hanging out, spinning yarns.
Gilbert's like, my man, I have been waiting.
I have been waiting for this since I was 16 years old. I'm gonna need you to leave.
Also, like, what time is the wedding that they can do all of this in a single day? Like, did they get married?
I think the wedding's at noon.
No,
like, even still. Wait, how long do we think that train ride took? So they took the train and then they took the buggy from the station.
Yeah.
60 what? Miles? I don't know.
Well, and I think it does says like they're married at noon so they can have kind of an early lunch and catch the Carmody train.
Yeah.
And they're driving at like sunset, right? Because they're like kind of watching the sunset.
It just seems like a long ass day to me.
It seems like it's a long day. Anyway, you know, well, good for Anne, right? Because especially we know she loves children. She wants a large family. That is another thing I clocked on this reread that I totally missed as a kid, right? How quickly Anne conceived. But you know, that early good luck in conceiving quickly also comes between Anne and her new friend, Leslie. Quote, "Anne could hardly discard it completely, for there were undoubtedly times when she felt, with an instinct that was not to be combated by reason, that Leslie harbored a queer, indefinable resentment toward her. At times, the secret consciousness marred the delight of their comradeship. At others, it was almost forgotten. But Anne always felt the hidden thorn was there and might prick her at any moment. She felt a cruel sting from it on the day when she told Leslie of what she hoped the spring would bring to the little house of dreams. Leslie looked at her with hard, bitter, unfriendly eyes. "So you are to have that, too," she said in a choked voice. And without another word, she had turned and gone across the fields homeward. Anne was deeply hurt. For the moment, she felt as if she could never like Leslie again. You know, and of course, Leslie is jealous and resentful. Yet again, Anne has something that Leslie thinks she will never have, because Leslie is trapped in this terrible marriage that was never happy to begin with, but now has turned into a caretaking relationship with a man who has the mind of a toddler.
And it calls back a little bit to Anne watching Diana and baby Fred, not as dramatically, of course. Anne's pregnancy highlights Leslie's feelings of loneliness and despair, but it was easier for Anne to be happy for Diana, even as she felt a little desolate herself, than it is for Leslie, who has had all of the hope drummed out of her. And while Leslie's specific circumstances are particularly unusual, I think many people have been on either or both sides of this type of situation, perhaps struggling with infertility while other people seem to get pregnant so easily, or maybe not being in an easy position to get pregnant due to relationship status, or being on the other side of it, feeling like they can't talk about or celebrate a pregnancy because they know a friend is struggling in some way emotionally in that area. There's just no easy way through those complicated feelings. You can know intellectually that babies are not a zero-sum quantity. One person being pregnant over here isn't reducing the possibility of you getting pregnant over there, but it still can feel that way. Like it's this cruel trick of the universe. There aren't a finite amount of pregnancies available at any one time, but it still feels really hard to see someone else easily have something that you are emotionally desperate for. I've certainly been on that side of it for sure. In fact, the year I was trying to get pregnant with my daughter and so afraid that it wouldn't happen for us, I was working in a program for pregnant women and mothers. I was literally surrounded by pregnant ladies and babies all the time, every day. And here I was realizing it was sometimes a lot harder to have a baby than the high school sex ed classes threatened that it would be. I was teaching parenting classes. I was asked at least once a week when I was going to hurry up and have a baby. It was kind of torturous. It was a rough year for that reason.
Yeah, Reagan, that is so incredibly, incredibly tough. And I get it, right? I mean, in the years that I tried to get pregnant, those were some of the most miserable years of my life. And I mean, like, to be fair, I had a few other things going on with like my career and some of my family relationships that contributed to that. But that feeling of wanting to be pregnant, wanting to be a mom and not being able to conceive when it seemed like every other person with a uterus on planet Earth got pregnant all at once, like celebrities, my friends, colleagues. It was very hard, you know, and I'm exaggerating, of course, right? But that is really what it feels like when you were like in the thick of dealing with infertility. And all your ambivalence toward other people's babies and pregnancy somehow evaporates. And now it all feels so intensely personal. You know, that's that zero sum game you were talking about, Reagan, like their gain is your loss, even though, of course, you know, that's not how it works. Suffice it to say that I really understand Leslie's bitterness when she says, "So you are to have that too."
Yeah, you don't want to feel like you would be somebody who thinks that way.
No.
It's hard not to feel that way sometimes, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And what I found, the thing I found with infertility is that you just have to make peace with it or else you risk living in that misery and bitterness forever. But whatever that looks like, hopefully for people who absolutely know they want to be parents, they do find a way to be, right? Whether that's through medical assistance or adoption. But I also know that there is a great deal of peace and happiness in choosing not to be a parent after all. You know, I know that for my husband and me, when we understood that we weren't going to get pregnant without medical assistance, and then when we also realized we didn't really want to go through that, that really helped us understand that maybe we didn't want to be parents like we assumed we did. Like once it wasn't the default setting or a foregone conclusion, and it was instead something we were going to have to pursue really deliberately and at great emotional, physical, and financial cost, we really realized we weren't as into it as we thought we were. Looking back, I see that time in our lives as like a great gift. This was a time when I really got to slow down and deliberately and intentionally choose the kind of life I was going to live without just sort of falling into that expected next phase of life of motherhood or parenthood.
Yeah, but that's probably only a feeling you can get with a little bit of distance, right? In the moment, oh, yeah. I'm sure it didn't feel that way. It didn't feel like a gift.
No, it really didn't. I mean, this is with the perspective of several years now. So I'm here to tell you that there is life and a lot of joy on the other side, but it's rough when you're in the thick of it. It really is.
Yeah, it's not the same, but it's related. But I went through something similar when we experienced kind of secondary infertility after Alice was born, you know, and that involved like ectopic pregnancies and all sorts of fun extra things involved with that. And I figured the first baby was the hard part and that the second baby would be like kind of a foregone conclusion for us. That'd be easy peasy, but that was very much not the case. And we even seriously considered pursuing adoption. But once we let ourselves embrace the idea of Alice being an only child, of being a family of three, that ended up feeling really good. And we really leaned into embracing the pros of a small family, but it was a process.
Yeah, for me, it was the process of losing pregnancies. It's like a lot of pregnancies that made it really hard to access joy for others. I remember my first miscarriage happened. It was a Thanksgiving weekend, and my cousin's child was born the same weekend. And it was like
Oof.
months before I could send a gift. I was like,
Oh,
gonna
Brenna.
not do that for a while. So I really get Leslie. Like, I get her so much. And I feel like Leslie has every right to be like, wow, my life sucks when she gives into these moments, you know? And it's interesting because we'll talk about like later the way that tragedy allows Anne to understand Leslie more later. But I just think it's just so hard to navigate that feeling of like you've just gotten such a raw deal. And obviously, like Leslie has that to the umpteenth power. Like everything from the death of her brother to her mother making her marry this guy, like it's all been bad. And so then you have friggin' Anne and Gilbert moving next door. Like, are you kidding me?
They're
That was
like,
this
yeah, they're
perfect,
dancing on cloud
beautiful.
nine. And it's this perfect, lovely marriage, and he adores her, and she's so sweet and lovely, and everybody loves her. And
No, thanks.
yeah, it's awful. And I think the three of us, I'm sure, all felt this to one degree or another in our own way, but just this is what you do, right? The pressure to be a mother, the pressure to be a parent is intense. And as intense as it was for the three of us, I'm sure, like at this time,
Well,
it would have
yeah.
been consuming. So, in addition to not being able to have kids because of her marital situation, it's almost like she's not able to fulfill her job as a woman. It's, I mean, just on so many levels, it's so painful for Leslie.
Well, Leslie's really existing in this liminal space, right? Because she's not really a wife. She can't be a mother. And she's also not like Miss Cornelia. She can't like embrace spinsterhood either. She's a full-time carer. And she can't be the kind of career woman that she maybe thought she might be as well, right? She talks about how she had planned to teach and like do all the things that Anne had the opportunity to do. So, yeah, she almost exists in this state of non-personhood for the time period.
I think that's a really profound insight, Brenna.
And of course, Leslie's not anywhere close to making peace with her circumstances yet, probably because she is still in that liminal space. Limbo is hard. Limbo is almost the worst part. So, because she's still in it, she's not in a place yet to make peace with it. And whatever Leslie's process is of working through that duality of feeling grief with her own circumstances and joy for her dear friend, she does get somewhere with it. We don't get to see how she does that, because she does later leave that beautifully detailed baby dress in a box for Anne to find, but the two never talk about it again. This is what the text says. But when Leslie came over a few evenings later, she was so pleasant, so friendly, so frank and witty and winsome that Anne was charmed into forgiveness and forgetfulness. Only she never mentioned her darling hope to Leslie again, nor did Leslie ever refer to it. And at some point, that does have to feel a little weird, right? Because they spend a lot of time together. So I know back then, maybe pregnancy wasn't discussed quite as frankly and openly as it is now. But you've got to think that at some point, it becomes very obvious that they aren't talking about it. Anne and Miss Cornelia are making all the baby clothes and setting up the nursery, and Leslie's just ignoring it.
Yeah, I mean, of course that would be weird. First of all, even just like the physicality of pregnancy, you're just gonna like ignore the fact that your friend is now very obviously pregnant. It's weird. It's a weird thing. And you know, just because Maud won't write the word pregnant in her books doesn't mean that women would not have discussed pregnancy and delivery and parenting among themselves, right? And we know that Anne and Gilbert specifically were sharing their news with all their family and friends based on all those beautiful gifts and all the support and well wishes that arrived from their friends. You know, for Leslie to be the lone outlier here among all of Anne's friends, there's no way it wouldn't stand out. But fortunately, Anne is a very gracious and emotionally generous friend who I think can understand where Leslie is coming from. So when baby Joyce does finally arrive, it's after a long and agonizing labor. Maud doesn't give us any details, but Marilla is pacing, and Susan Baker, the new live-in help, has cotton stuffed in her ears and her apron over her head in the kitchen, which I think that's a little dramatic, but I do see what we're trying to get at here. Dr. Dave is there with his nurse to attend to the labor, and Gilbert is obviously upstairs with Anne. The text alludes to Anne being in danger of dying, which, of course, was a very real possibility, certainly for the time, and Marilla and Susan are clearly petrified for Anne. Quote, "Do not tell me," said Susan fiercely, answering the anguish in Marilla's eyes, "that God could be so cruel as to take that darling lamb from us when we all love her so much." Marilla responds, "He has taken others as well beloved," relying on her faith in Providence, of course, to see her through this scary moment.
Cue me crying at the pool.
Right?
Yep.
This scene is harrowing. It's the chlorine.
Exactly. It is harrowing.
Yes. What?
Okay. So like, again, I read this book as a kid. Not recommended. This is a very adult book. And I remember this scene made me absolutely terrified of childbirth. Do you guys remember how you felt reading this book when you were younger? And then what now, reading as an adult, especially adults who have delivered babies, what stands out to you?
I do think it's really impressive how much tension Maud was able to build out of so very little details. She's very effective at conveying how truly in danger Anne is in. Although I think I had the opposite experience of you as a kid, Kelly, in which I did not really pick up some of the hints, like when I first read it, maybe as a kid, how it was really alluding to this possibility of Anne dying. I don't think I attended to that as much when I was younger. It wasn't until I reread it, maybe, you know, in my early 20s or whatever, the next time I reread it, that I really picked up this experience of, oh no, this was something that was very, very dangerous for Anne. So I think it was only later in life.
This was definitely a book that really shaped my general sense that like having to exist within a body is a horror. And like, we shouldn't have to do it. My like lifelong quest to just be a brain in a jar. This scene definitely had a big impact on that. Yeah.
That seems like a very rational takeaway.
Well, so I looked up some basic information about maternal mortality and childbirth at that time when we were writing this episode. And of course, records are spotty because many babies were not delivered in a hospital in Anne's time. So take with that what you will. But in the 20th century, things did start to improve for women in childbirth with the advent of antibiotics and drugs that helped to prevent hemorrhages. Although this was, I thought, what was interesting, things actually got worse before they got better. Because as doctors started to be more involved and more babies were born in hospitals rather than assisted by midwives at home, the doctors' more invasive procedures kind of outpaced best practices. And often they spread germs during their interventions that caused puerperal fever.
That sounds bad.
Yeah. It was also called childbed fever, which is what I'm going to say because I can't pronounce that very well. But it's a bacterial infection caused by streptococci bacteria. By the 1930s, stronger antibiotics were developed, hygiene practices increased, and by the 40s, medical trainings improved. So weirdly, and likely unintentionally on Maud's part, Anne may have actually survived her perilous childbirth because, as you remember, Dr. Dave doesn't hold with too many modern interventions, thus not endangering Anne further with a risk of sepsis or childbed fever or as much of.
It's funny because I used to read about how like doctors were super down on washing their hands and they'd like make people who were making them wash their hands. They'd drum them out of the hospitals and stuff because they were like, you can't make me wash my hands. And I was like, that's weird that they felt that way. And then hospitals stopped wearing masks in the middle of a pandemic. Right. And I was like, oh no, we're just going to be like this forever.
Cool. Right. And then COVID happened and you're like, yeah. Oh no, we actively act against our best interest all the time.
All the time.
Well, so Brenna, let me share with you a little more information that I found out about this very thing, because I have been boring the pants off my husband with this story since I read about it. So there is a doctor named Ignaz Semmelweis in the mid-1800s in Vienna, and he was the first to realize that the hygiene of the doctor was related to maternal mortality. And it turned out the reason he figured it out was that there were two birthing wings in the teaching hospital. And one was staffed by doctors and doctors in training, and the other was staffed by midwives and midwives in training. And women were admitted on alternate days to the different wings. So it accidentally set up this perfectly randomized study. And the women in the doctor's wing of the hospital, 10 to 18% of them, depending on the year, died following childbirth, whereas an average of 2% of women died following childbirth in the midwife's wing. And Semmelweis was the one who put together the pieces that the doctors were often going directly from autopsies of women who had died from childbed fever to assisting in childbirth, wearing the same clothes without washing their hands and sometimes using the same implements.
Horrifying. Oh, God.
My God.
So he was the one, he advocated strict, harsh hand washing regimens using like carbolic acid type things after autopsies and using chlorine bleach on medical implements. And it worked. The percentage of women dying dropped dramatically, like immediately, like the next month after this. But doctors were super resistant and felt like they're gentlemen. Of course, their hands are clean.
Oh, geez.
Drummed him out of Vienna, where he returned to Hungary, and he died at age 47 after he was committed to an asylum. He died 14 days after he was committed to this asylum by his colleagues, because he was getting like more and more incensed about this and like writing kind of, I guess, unhinged letters accusing doctors of basically committing, you know, being murderers. And then he was committed to the asylum. And yeah, early medicine was a wild place to be, you guys. Or medicine now, honestly.
That is horrifying. That's so crazy, Reagan. But, you know, I believe it. I totally believe it. It makes perfect sense. And I think that a lot of midwives, they knew what they were doing, more or less. I mean, like, obviously, there are certain things that they just wouldn't have had the technology for interventions for. But like basic stuff, they were getting right. I actually have a copy of like an old pamphlet from the early 1800s, like from the Regency era. And it's about pregnancy and midwifery. But that pamphlet does mention like cleaning up the area using water that had been boiled, so sterilized water. So that was just an ancient pearl of wisdom, right? That kind of happened probably just through trial and error. And that actually does get to a common cause of infection.
Do you think in like 60 years, when we finally figured out that we should be purifying the air in like schools and hospitals and congregate care facilities, that like somebody will be making a podcast and they'll be reading some YA book from 2015 where like someone dies of an airborne infection and they're just, can you believe how primitive and ridiculous these people were?
Absolutely, God. Brenna. I know there's like a couple things that I think that we're going to look back on. I certainly hope we'll look back on in 50 or 60 years and be like, what were we thinking?
Yeah. It's probably worth noting here just like some timeline stuff, which you guys maybe have already gotten to, but the action of the book is probably taking place 1890, 1891. And we can pinpoint that based on the election results, because that would have been Wilfrid Laurier's Liberal government coming into power in 1891, getting rid of Sir John A. Macdonald finally.
Canadian history for the win. Your history teacher is so proud. She used it.
So true. But the book was written and published in 1917, probably written through 1914, 1915. It's worth noting that Montgomery experienced the stillbirth of, I'm pretty sure it was her second son, Hugh Alexander, in 1914. So that would have been 3 years before the publication of House of Dreams. Also, just as World War I is starting, which if you guys do ever do the Blythes Are Quoted, we can talk about war trauma and Lucy Maud Montgomery. This is one of the periods of depression in Montgomery's life. Shapes the misery she felt writing Anne of the Island, which apparently was the most miserable book for her to write of the series. She was
interesting.
Yeah, she was extremely stressed. It's the only book where she missed the publication deadline or the submission deadline, I'm pretty sure, from her editors. And also her later traumatic reaction to the start of World War II is probably an echoing back to this period in her life. So it's not a surprise to me that we have the childbirth scene that we have in this book, because I think Montgomery is really kind of writing back to that experience in the wake of it. She's right in that period of time. Yeah.
This feels emergent. This feels like of her life. And I think we'll refer back to this a little bit later on, but it's one of these things where I think we have this scene in part because Maud is speaking to the experiences of so many women at that time, right? And she knows that her women readers can handle a scene like this because their lives will have been touched by this in some way.
Absolutely.
So in any case, Anne's delivery is difficult and scary, and tragically, Anne only has one glorious hour of joyful motherhood before she realizes that poor little baby Joyce is dying. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And unfortunately, this kind of scenario wasn't at all uncommon. even in the books, we know that Mrs. Allen lost an infant. I think that's referenced in Anne of Avonlea. And there's just such a crushing grief to losing a child and to have the experience of motherhood snatched out from under Anne just as she has entered into the joy and the glory of it just seems so, so cruel. Maud describes Anne's happiness after Joyce's birth like this, quote, Anne, her pale face blanched with its baptism of pain, her eyes aglow with the holy passion of motherhood, did not need to be told to think of her baby. She thought of nothing else. For a few hours, she tasted of happiness so rare and exquisite that she wondered if the angels in heaven did not envy her.
That's a beautiful quote, as we said earlier, but I don't know about your experience, Brenna, but I'm pretty sure that is not what I experienced in the immediate aftermath of my daughter's birth.
No singing angels, Reagan?
No, there were no angels. I had an unplanned C-section, so I didn't even get to hold her right away. Like, they brought her over so I could see her and, like, kiss her head. So by the time I did hold her, I was, like, in this fog of exhaustion and hunger. It was, like, 2 a.m. It had been in labor, like, 24 hours. I was still, shaky from the surgery, so it all felt, like, kind of unreal. So it was maybe more like 12 hours later when I finally was alone with her by myself in my room and I was able to pick her up and cuddle her and sing to her. And then I felt like, oh, okay, I'm her mom and this is my baby.
Yeah, I had emergency C-section too, and I couldn't get to my kiddo because he was in the NICU and I couldn't get out of my hospital bed. And at one point they wheeled my bed into the NICU, which was very nice of them, but also super just weird.
Yeah.
Just a really trippy, weird experience. So it was a long time before I got to hold him. And I also had the experience that nothing really felt quite real until that had happened. It all felt so not like it was even happening to me. That's probably also the drugs, but it definitely didn't feel like I was the person in the experience. And it really wasn't until, yeah, he was finally able to be taken out of the incubator that it was like, oh yeah, you're a person. I made you and you're right there. But it was not real until that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is almost a moment that needs to happen. I do think it is very interesting that Maud describes motherhood as this holy experience, because this isn't the only line in which she does it. She talks about Anne having been baptized by the pain of childbirth. And back in Anne of the Island, when Anne sees Diana following the birth of baby Fred, she observes that Diana was, quote, bathed in the wonderful glory that comes to a woman when her firstborn is laid beside her. So Maud is very much framing the process of becoming a mother as a spiritual experience and as a kind of fulfillment of womanly purpose. And that's even though she has given us many examples in her books of wonderful women who did not choose the path of motherhood.
Do you think this is maybe related to the fact that she is at this point in life realizing that, so she's married Ewan MacDonald, right, in 1911, yep. And it's bad. But not only is it a bad marriage just because he sounds like he was kind of an arse, but also he totally doesn't respect her writing, even though she's the family breadwinner, which becomes a huge tension in their relationship. He's like this man of God, although we think maybe he was an atheist, which is another whole interesting thing. But anyway, whatever. He's a Presbyterian minister. He's like that got this spiritual career, and he doesn't respect the work that she does that really is actually the thing putting food on their table. And so the sanctification of her role as the mother, or the sanctification of Anne's role as the mother here, because this is not related to this episode at all, but it drives me crazy how much Anne puts down her own writing in this book.
Oh, yes.
Over and over again, she minimizes stories. I just hear these echoes of this marriage that she's now 3, 4, 5 years into and realizing, oh God.
Yeah. Well, I wonder whether, because we've talked about that before in other contexts, whether there's a little bit of wish fulfillment here.
Yes.
Her, of something that even though this moment of Joyce's death is so terrible and difficult, it's in this context of this loving marriage and Anne can choose to put her writing down, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't have to support the family. And it's just easier, right? Like Anne's experience here, even amidst the tragedy, is so much easier. Like she's loved, she's supported. She can choose to do with her writing what she wants. And almost maybe, I don't know, you know, I'm not a Montgomery scholar, but whether there's something about she lets Anne be really fulfilled by motherhood because maybe she wasn't 100% fulfilled by motherhood herself and wishes she could have been, especially I think in the wake of a terrible marriage, if you can find the joy in your children and fulfillment, maybe that takes the edge off a terrible marriage that is not fulfilling emotionally. I don't know. That's pure speculation.
No.
I think the point about especially using that sort of like religious language and knowing that Maud's husband, of course, was a minister, it's almost a little bit where she's saying, my work is holy too. You might be a minister, but I'm a mother and that work is holy too.
Yeah.
Right. And she's kind of fighting back in her, at least in her prose. And then I also think, you know, as modern readers, we're probably missing some like Victorian cultural and religious context here. I mean, of course, we know that Anne becoming a mother did fulfill a beloved dream of hers. And of course, like every mother, her life is forever changed in this moment. But, you know, in this era, becoming a mother was the absolute pinnacle of achievement for a woman, right? Motherhood meant that you had consummated your sort of God-given mission. So yes, this holy Madonna and child type language here would be very much in keeping with Victorian values. We don't know exactly why little Joyce doesn't live, but Gilbert is the one to break the news to Anne, although we don't hear what he tells her, instead hearing only Anne's heartbroken moans. Marilla tells Susan that there is no hope for Joyce and that Gilbert knew at once that she wouldn't live. We hear from Susan that Joyce is very small, white, and pale, and that's all we ever learn about this poor child.
So according to some of my basic research, infant mortality rates, I found infant mortality rates in Montreal in the 19th century, not specific to Prince Edward Island. But at the time, they were about 250 per 1,000 live births. And for comparison, currently the rate of infant mortality is below 5 per 1,000 live births. But nearly 30% of babies born didn't make it to their first birthdays in the 1800s. And at the beginning of the 1800s, nearly 43% of children died before their fifth birthday. Over the course of the 1800s, that dipped over time. But still, it was distressingly common for a whole host of reasons, right? No antibiotics meant dying of common infections, lots of illnesses that we can now vaccinate for or treat, poor nutrition, lack of safety standards, just more dangerous environments. So all of it meant that so many young children died far too early.
Your source for this, Reagan, the guy who wrote this textbook is one of my colleagues at TRU.
No kidding. Really?
Yeah.
Stop, that's so funny.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
All right, then. All right. Verified. Well, question for you both. Why do you think Maud included this moment for Anne? Why was it important to her to show this aspect of motherhood to make her heroine experience such a profound loss?
Okay, first of all, it's so hard. We love Anne and Gilbert, and we don't want this for them. We don't want them to suffer like this. But I mentioned a little earlier, I think that Maud really is serving a different audience when she wrote this moment for Anne. This is an Anne fanfic. Mm-hmm. She's writing for her readers, mostly women, who have known this kind of loss. You know, as you pointed out, Reagan, child loss was unfortunately very common at the time the book was set, and her readers' lives would have been touched by this in some way. If not them, then a friend, a sister, someone in their families. And I think she knows that for readers, seeing Anne weather this storm is going to bring a lot of comfort to the people who love Anne.
I also think Montgomery believes and maybe has to believe, given what we know about her own story's arc, that tragedy makes us whole, that tragedy makes us human. And if we think back to the language in Anne of Green Gables about Matthew's death, we're effectively told that Anne doesn't enter adulthood until she loses Matthew. And it's that moment, you know, there's that, I can't remember the line, but it's about how she'll wake up the next morning, like this fully changed person after experiencing the death of Matthew. And I think in many ways, she doesn't fully enter womanhood until the loss of Joyce. Like there's this notion that she is still in this very carefree girlhood right up until this loss, right? Think about her dancing on the beach and all of these things that are sort of classically Anne as we know her, that all of that fades away after Joy's death. So, you know, we're told many times in the series that the tragedy of Anne's childhood makes her interesting, even makes her good, right? That she's had all these experiences. And in many ways, you know, we've talked before about the books as wish fulfillment. I know you guys have talked about it in other episodes as wish fulfillment, but the tragedies almost make them real, right? Like that's what tempers the fantasy notion of the book. And then to be really boring from a plot point, there's no deepening of the friendship with Leslie without the loss of Joyce, right? Like Anne has to experience some great tragedy in order for for Leslie to feel like Anne can never understand her. And maybe Leslie's wrong about that, but it doesn't really matter because it's what she believes about their relationship. And I think, too, we see it in the way Captain Jim can't really share the pain of lost Margaret until Anne lives through her great loss, right? He tells Anne everything, but he's never mentioned Margaret until she goes through the loss of Joyce. So I think Montgomery's really aware that grief is this place where we find deep connections with those who are willing to stand in it with us. And Anne, you know, the loss of Matthew is life-changing. It really is that moment of leaving childhood behind. But Anne doesn't fully learn grief until she has this sort of loss out of time with Joyce. And I think that that's so important to Montgomery's understanding of how we connect with other people and how we grow as people, unfortunately.
Yeah. I see it in the text too. You hear the way Anne is described in the first half of the book versus the second half of the book is very different. You hear about like the laughing young bride of the House of Dreams versus, you know, obviously she's still Anne, still daydreamy, still full of all the things we love about her, but she, you know, has this somber quality that the text tells us she will never be without again.
Mm-hmm. Well, baby Joyce is born at sunrise. Quote, when the rising sun rent apart the mists hanging over the sandbar and made rainbows of them. And she dies at sunset. So there's some interesting symmetry here. We learned in Anne of the Island that Anne herself was born at sunrise and that the light from the dawn on Anne's face was the first thing Bertha Shirley saw after her labor. When Anne explored the little house where her parents lived, including the room where she was born, she has this experience. Quote, Anne went up the narrow stairs and into that little east room with a full heart. It was a shrine to her. Here her mother had dreamed the exquisite, happy dreams of anticipated motherhood. Here that red sunrise light had fallen over them both in the sacred hour of her birth. Here her mother had died. Anne looked about her reverently, her eyes dim with tears. It was for her one of the jeweled hours of life that gleam out radiantly forever in memory. And so again, we have the religious connotations, shrine, sacred, reverent. And I have to wonder if Anne recalls this in the hour after Joyce's birth and feels connected to her mother. This is an experience that she knows they shared. And you'll notice that direct echo of the word exquisite to describe the dreams of motherhood for both Anne and for her mom. And both of these experiences end with Anne left behind. First as a daughter without her mother, and then as a mother without her daughter.
Oh, Reagan, that's really beautifully, beautifully observed.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also some symmetry later in this book with Captain Jim crossing the bar at sunrise. It makes symbolic sense that coming into the world and leaving it at these transitional moments between day and night, which is often characterized by gorgeous colors and plays of light that last only briefly and exist only as a liminal state. Captain Jim's death is after a long, full life, and dying at sunrise sort of illustrates that it's not a sorrowful death. Dawn brings a new day, after all, a new day for Captain Jim in whatever comes next. Joyce's death at sunset, as day turns to darkness, as joy turns to sorrow, speaks to the bereft grief that Anne experiences. Well, kindred spirits, we are actually going to pause here. When we listened to the raw audio of this episode after we finished it, turns out we had almost 3 hours worth of material, and even with some strict editing, had a pretty hard time getting it down to a listenable length without losing what we felt were some really good discussions. So we're going to do something we've never done before, and we are going to break this episode in half. Our next episode will be the conclusion of this discussion of Anne's journey to motherhood with Brenna Clark Gray. We'll talk about how this grief changes Anne, how the birth of Jem brings hope and healing for her, as well as some fun sidebars where we come back to Miss Cornelia and the Methodist-Presbyterian divide and the benefits of baby talk, as well as some inspired by House of Dreams recommendations.
We would love it if you continue to share the podcast with the kindred spirits in your life. Let us know if you've reviewed the podcast on Apple Podcasts or if you've shared about us on social media, and we will send you a high-quality vinyl KSBC sticker. It is so cute. It is sage green. It's square. It looks just like our logo. Reach out and let us know how you shared the pod, either via email at kindredspirits.bookclub@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at kindredspirits.bookclub. And while you're there, be sure to give us a follow. We are always posting fun bookish content on Instagram.
And we're both there pretty regularly, so it is a great way to interact, get recommendations, see pictures of our ever-growing collections of Anne of Green Gables books, and give us awesome recommendations for our upcoming trip to Prince Edward Island. Kindred Spirits, thank you so much for listening, and don't forget to join us next time.
Bye, Kindred Spirits!